From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump and Joe Biden hit the campaign trail today, leaving behind the rubble of last night's debate. President Trump failed to call out white supremacists when asked to do so, and he repeatedly disregarded debate rules, interrupting the moderator and Joe Biden. Occasionally, Biden fired back, at one point telling the president to shut up. It's being called one of the worst debates ever. Here's an exchange on whether Biden would add justices to the Supreme Court.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
The you question
put a
is,
lot of
the
new
question
Supreme
is,
Court justice, the radical question, left.
Will you
who
shut
is
up,
on,
man.
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on your
so
list?
Right.
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
Unprecedented.
He's going to pack the court.
Yes, this is so unprecedential. Our political strategist joined us. Alice Stewart is the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Great to be here.
Yeah, Bill Press, the Democrat. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Robin. Hi, Alice.
And it's great to have you both, but this is not a good morning, and that was not a good night. Let's play the exchange in which the president was asked by a completely disempowered moderator, Chris Wallace, to disavow white supremacists and Nazis. Let's listen.
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see
well,
peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists and
would
right
you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
The Proud Boys, which is a right-wing organization, clubs really, immediately made a badge saying stand back and stand by. And they said they are awaiting the president's call. One could speculate, Alice, maybe to stand guard at polls, as the president called on his followers to do last night. That's voter intimidation. Alice, wasn't the president sending a signal to white supremacists and Nazi groups last night that he was not going to disavow them?
I hope not, but it's difficult to understand exactly what his motive was when he said stand back and stand by. Look, when you're asked to denounce a hate group, whether it is a white supremacist group or Antifa or the KKK or any organization that thrives on hate and burning buildings and attacking police and attacking other people, anything short of a full-throated, wholehearted, unequivocal condemnation is just not sufficient. And the question that the president was asked by Chris Wallace to condemn these white supremacists should have been a simple, absolutely, I condemn them. And he cannot say that strong enough, and he cannot say that often enough. So I feel like it was an opportunity where saying stand back and stand by was nowhere close to the kind of answer that he should have been given. He has denounced them in the past, but this was a great opportunity to give a full-throated condemnation, and it didn't happen.
Well, and by the way, you mentioned Antifa, anti-fascists. According to our intelligence, and I you know, have to, you know, correct this, that is a loose movement, much smaller, and it's an ideology. It is not an organization. Proud Boys is an organization with membership in clubs and such. So there's a distinct difference. One is much more in stone and dangerous. And Alice, I'm wondering, why aren't we hearing other Republicans today outside of Tim Scott, who called on the president to clarify himself? Why aren't we hearing Republicans say something?
We have. I mean, I've seen quite a few interviews and read comments where people had wished that he had been certainly a lot more vocal on this. But a lot of them do go back to reminding the people that they're talking with that the president has condemned hate groups in the past, and he has said that there's no place for the KKK and such organizations. But, you know, it's just unfortunate, given the audience and the opportunity of a presidential debate, that it wasn't a more heartfelt and unequivocal condemnation.
Well, and Bill Press, I know you want to take this up too, but I want to ask you as well, did Joe Biden make a mistake? I mean, we'll get to his overall performance, but did he make a mistake in, at some points, taking the bait? He told the president to shut up, called him a clown at one point. Could he have just completely removed himself from this chaos that President Trump created? And should he have?
Okay, let me first speak to the white supremacists, if I can. I mean, it's almost at a time when we're beyond being shocked by anything Donald Trump says. But yet, I think this was extremely stunning, shocking, and frightening. It was, for me, one of two frightening moments of the debate. But he had, Chris Wallace, as Alice just pointed out, teed him up. This was an easy question to answer. He did not. Instead, he empowered the Proud Boys. They came out with a slogan. They took that stand back and stand by, made it their slogan last night. They had T-shirts for sale last night with that slogan on it. And the head of Proud Boys said, this is Donald Trump telling us to go F them up. That's what they see. It's a green light for violence. This is Charlottesville, deja vu, all over again. And I just cannot understand, like you, Robin, why leading Republicans, I don't mean some commentators, leading Republicans are not denouncing this and condemning this today. As to Joe Biden, I thought Joe Biden showed remarkable restraint last night. Look, it's just not fair to say that there are two people responsible for that train wreck or dumpster fire or whatever you want to call it. There was one monster. Mm-hmm. There was one bully on the stage. There was one candidate that the moderator pleaded with repeatedly to please shut up and let the other person speak and to please abide by the rules, and that was Donald Trump. Conduct that unworthy of a barroom brawl, let alone a presidential debate.
Okay, Chris Wallace, Fox News, did. I thought he was going to do, and I wish he had stopped it. I wish he had stopped it and said, you know, we're stopping. You're not abiding by the rules. Instead, he paused it to say to President Trump, Alice, there's one person interrupting more than the other. You agreed, your party, your campaign agreed to abide by the rules. You are not. What about the overall appearance, Alice, this lumbering, red-faced, sweaty, interrupting? I mean, what kind of an – we know that President Trump is trying to win suburban women.
Right.
What was the impact?
And there are two takes. You know, the president always likes to empower his base and satisfy his base. They loved watching the president take on not just Joe Biden but Chris Wallace, because in their mind, he is the bull in the china shop, and the way he fights them, he will fight for them with jobs in the economy. But the question is, the issue is, how is this appealing to women and the undecided voters who need to be won over by these debates? I don't see how he moved the needle in any way. If anything, it was a net loss in that regard. The women saw the tone and temperament and were turned off, where on the other side, Joe Biden, I do think, does deserve some praise for not taking the bait as often as he could, looking directly into the camera, appealing directly to voters, making an impassioned plea on many key issues. That will go a long way. And that kind of a demeanor is certainly the kind of demeanor that will help persuade undecided and specifically suburban women to go their way.
Yeah, well,
Robin,
we know
that
Frank Luntz. Yeah, but go ahead.
A quick point is this was, everybody said this ahead of time. The polls for so long have been favoring Joe Biden. This was Donald Trump's really last chance with 35 days to go to turn this around and to get some momentum going on his side by reaching out, particularly to women, to suburban women. He totally failed to do that. He never looked at the camera. He never addressed the audience. He never reached out. And I think the impact to your question, Robin, is that this may be too late now to turn it around, because millions of people are going to vote before October 15, and there are very few people left undecided. So Donald Trump had a great opportunity last night. I think we would agree that he blew it.
Well, here's Republican pollster Frank. Oh, hold on, Alice. Hold on. Republican pollster Frank Luntz, after the debate, always has his polling of undecided voters. He had several words they used to describe President Trump. They were not positive at all. One woman said she thought the president acted like a crackhead. The group felt that President Biden was the presidential one of the two. And one Pennsylvania woman said she was now voting for Biden. But I just – hold on one second, Alice. I just want to ask you, Bill – Joe Biden also struggled at times. He couldn't name a law enforcement union that supported him after claiming one. He couldn't answer a question about whether he'd pack the Supreme Court. Your thoughts on just how he got his views out?
First, I'm not saying that Joe Biden put in a perfect night, right, or was the ideal debater at all. But compared to Donald Trump, I thought he looked calm. He looked cool. He looked knowledgeable about the issues. He had a plan. He came prepared. And he certainly was not the senile person that Donald Trump had tried to paint him ahead of time. So I thought Joe Biden won and Donald Trump lost the debate.
Alice, I want to let you in. Do you think there should be another one?
Absolutely. And the American people deserve to see another debate, but it certainly needs to be with both candidates following the rules and the restrictions. I'm not sure what short of a shock collar can make that happen, but Donald Trump needs to tone it down and Joe Biden needs to bring more of what he brought to the table last night.
I agree completely.
Do you think, did this hurt President Trump? He didn't win any points. Did it hurt him, Alice?
I don't think so, but it certainly gives him an opportunity to raise the bar next time.
Alice Stewart, the Republican, Bill Press, the Democrat. We all need Tums. Thanks, you guys, so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Alice.
Jim Parsons is probably best known as Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory. You know, the brainiac who can make a game of rock, paper, scissors complicated.
Anecdotal evidence suggests that in a game of rock, paper, scissors, players familiar with each other will tie 75 to 80% of the time due to the limited number of outcomes. I suggest rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock.
Well, today you can get to know a very different Jim Parsons. Still funny, but with an even sharper edge. Parsons stars in a new Netflix production of Mark Crowley's groundbreaking play, The Boys in the Band. He plays Michael, a gay man living in New York City in the late 1960s, who's throwing a birthday party for his friend Harold. If you can call him a friend, the party ends up a disaster. Here's Michael speaking with his house guest, Donald, played by Matt Bomer.
Oh, you had to remind me. God, if there is one thing I'm not ready for, it is five screaming queens singing happy birthday.
Who's coming?
I think you know everybody anyway. And same old tired fairies you've seen around since day one. Actually, you know what? There'll be seven, counting Harold and you and me.
Are you calling me a screaming queen or a tired fairy?
Oh, I beg your pardon. There'll be six tired screaming fairy queens and one anxious queer.
The Boys in the Band debuted off-Broadway in 1968. A 2018 Broadway production celebrating the play's 50th anniversary won a Tony, and the entire cast is back in the Netflix film version. We've got Jim Parsons here with us now. Jim, welcome. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
And I know you weren't around in 1968. You didn't know much of the play until you had the chance to read the script, but now I'm sure you know that this was a huge deal when it first came out. This was a year before the Stonewall riots ignited the gay rights movement. The play was shocking to people. No one was ready to accept gay men at that time.
No, and one of the seminal things about this play in 1968 was that it was the first time that gay men had been given the central characters, or the only characters in any piece that was presented, and it was really one of the first, if not the first, look inside gay culture, gay, what it was to be a gay person inside their own homes and in their when they collected together. People found that intriguing and wonderful even. But it soon after Stonewall did happen and gay liberation began, and this piece has really gone through a tumultuous history as far as it being rejected in many corners at different times by the very community it aimed to represent, who said, we don't want to be represented this way. These people seem to be self-hating. They have to hide. And time has, I don't want to say time has been kind to this piece, but this piece is, I believe, vital and was such an open vein for the author, Mark Crowley. What he wrote was so truthful and brutally honest from what he knew and saw and had been a part of that it has stuck around.
Well, some people in the community might agree that self-hate is off-putting in this, but, you know, frankly, it's one of the themes up front and center. Here's a clip from your character, Michael. He seems to hate himself at times, the fact that he's gay. He spends money as a form of therapy. His friends give him a hard time for being broke. And here he is with a house guest, Donald. And I do have to warn people that we're about to push up against the limits of what's safe for public radio here. So let's listen.
I went shopping today, and I bought all sorts of goodies. Look, sandalwood soap.
I feel better already.
Mm-hmm. Oh, your very own toothbrush, because I am sick to death of you using mine.
How do you think I feel?
You've had worse things in your mouth.
Okay, so interesting thing about this production, as you well know, the cast is made up of 9 gay men playing 9 right. gay characters. Tell me about right. that. Did that change the dynamic at all among the actors or bring something different to the show?
It's hard for me to know what the ultimate effect of having 9 out gay actors was on the show itself. For myself personally, it turned into a very powerful experience to be around all these gay men. I've never worked with a group that was all gay, or even probably half gay in most of the things I've done. And I didn't realize what I'd been missing. There is a specific thing about being gay. There is a specific thing about being a gay person, in this case, gay man, growing up in this country. You know, there's all these unique features that I kind of take for granted or don't give that much credence to. And when we were all together, there was just a feeling I had that it couldn't be taken for granted anymore. There was something important going on here.
Let's go back to the plot here just a little bit. As the night goes on in this party, it gets tense. An old friend yeah. shows up unexpectedly. He's married to a woman, but his sexuality is unclear. Then your character, Michael, suggests a game where each guest has to call someone that they've truly loved from their past on the telephone. Let's listen to this.
Now, here's how it works. If you make the call, you get 1 point. If the person you are calling answers, you get 2 more points. If somebody else answers, you only get 1. And if there's no answer at all, you're screwed.
This turns out to be some sort of messed up party game.
Yes,
and it's the point in the show. No, that well, good. I'm glad to hear that because you seem like a nice guy. But and that's
Thank
the point.
You.
I mean, at this point, you wonder if these guys really are yeah. friends at all. And Michael yeah. starts to show just a really cruel side, a dark side yeah. to his character. What's behind that tension? What's causing it?
One of the final lines in the play is the character of Harold that Zachary Quinto plays. He says to Michael, my character, you are a homosexual and you don't want to be, but there's nothing you can do about it. I do believe that's very much at the root cause of Michael's troubles. Michael and all these characters were living in a time where they were being told from all corners of what deviants they were. To me, one of the heartbreaking things, the premise of this game at its deepest point is to force, Michael wants to force each of them into going through this to realize how ridiculous the idea of true love is for a homosexual. That as a gay person, you will never know what it is to love, not in the way that everyone else gets to. And I just believe that they were living in a time that was teaching them that.
Is that something that resonates with you if you look back on your own life coming of age?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. And I'll tell you, one of the greatest blessings for me personally was that spending a couple of years essentially on and off with this cast, with this script, with this character, it really brought me to a place where, and it was a healthy thing. It wasn't overly painful. It was important, I think. But to realize that, you know, one of the blessings of the time that I live in as a gay man in America in 2020 is that there's not nearly the overt homophobic actions and statements and things to be exposed to every day. It's a completely different world than it was in 1968. The hiccup with that is that it makes it easier for someone like myself to ignore the more subtle ways in which I've been signaled in my youth, growing up, who knows, even now sometimes, little things that I'm like, oh, and you just kind of push it aside. But there is a part of me that does hurt. And to not acknowledge that nick, if you will, on your heart, on your soul, is to let it fester. I hope that makes sense. That's a little bit of
does.
A brain journey for you.
It certainly does. And you know what? Your Jim Parsons people love you. People know you as Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory. It's hard for me to even think of you as someone who isn't just loved by everybody. And I wonder how your fans respond when you take on a role like this. That is such a departure from this iconic character that you've become so well known for.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And it's one that, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but one that I kind of don't consider so much. I mean, the figuring out, as it were, remains the same now as it was for years now, which is, what's it going to be like to work with these people? What's it going to be like to work on this character? And in that process, what others will think of it is not, certainly not consciously on my list of considerations.
Hmm. By the way, how's the pandemic treating you? I heard you got COVID. Are you okay?
I did. Yeah, it was very early on. March 15th, I think, was the exact date. Me and my husband both got ill, and we didn't know what it was. It was still so early. We had a mild to moderate, at best, case. We were not, you know, we were not in dire straits at all. But there was chest pressure and there was fever. And the scariest part was going to bed each night and just worrying about being one of those cases that took a sudden turn where things were seemingly fine, if just a little ill. And then suddenly you were at a hospital somewhere. Mm. But we got over it. What was funny, though, we were feeling better. And that's when we both lost complete taste and smell. And it was so weird. But, you know, you can read about it and see about it. Everybody's cases are different. They have commonalities, but it just travels differently through everybody.
Jim Parsons, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Before I let you go, I just want to bring it back one more time to the boys in the band. The playwright, Mark Crowley, mm-hmm. as you know, died in March. There have been so many strides in the fight for equality. Is this play as powerful and relevant today as it was in 1968? And what do you think Mart would say about that?
I think Mart would be, frankly, a little bit surprised at the power and strength and longevity of his tale. I think that, like so many great works, they get realized their place in the canon, as it were, of great literature or moments in history much, much later. And partly that's because you can't know until it stood the test of time the way a piece like this has.
Jim Parsons stars in the revival of The Boys in the Band, which is out on Netflix today. Jim, thank you for speaking with us, and thank you for your work. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Tens of thousands of airline workers are about to be furloughed starting tomorrow if Congress doesn't reach a deal to bail out the industry. House Democrats are negotiating with Republicans on a fresh relief package that would prevent layoffs of airline workers through March 31st. But first, they have to pass it. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Peter.
No doubt airlines say they're on the cusp of disaster here. What is at stake as tomorrow's deadline approaches?
Well, most immediately, those jobs, as you mentioned, tens of thousands of airline workers who are waiting here with the clock ticking. But more broadly, first of all, indirect employment, because there are all kinds of other companies that depend on airlines whose workers might not be protected by a deal directly. But, you know, if airlines are flying less, then they don't need as much of all the other things that they do. And air service, to a degree, as much as airlines have cut in the past several months, you know, there have probably been more flights than there would have been because basically the jobs were subsidized, right? Airlines had to promise to keep people employed. And then it just kind of makes sense to do some flying that they wouldn't have otherwise done. So on one hand, yeah, they've cut roughly half their flights. Even now, on the other hand, they probably would have cut more.
Well, the airlines are scrambling ahead of this deadline tomorrow. United this week reached a deal with its pilots that would prevent 2,800 of them from being furloughed for a while. Delta and Southwest have also struck similar deals. What do they look like? What do those deals look like?
A lot of shared pain between the airlines and their pilots. So, for example, pilots are typically paid – it's kind of a variable pay package where they're guaranteed a minimum, but then depending on how much they fly – they get paid more. Well, they've basically agreed to be willing to fly less in exchange for still being employed. And these deals are not long-term deals. In the case of United, you know, we're talking through October. So this is by no means anything that really resets the clock for very long, but it does give them some time at least to, first of all, give Congress and the president a chance to make a deal and also to just sort of prevent airlines from having to deal themselves with the shock of losing so many pilots.
Right. You know, if those pilots are furloughed, how easy would it be to bring them back to work when all of this gets settled? I mean, they probably have to keep up their training and that sort of thing, right?
Exactly. And that's part of the logic to your last question of, you know, why it makes sense for airlines to meet them somewhere in the middle. Because if you knew that all of a sudden a month from now, you know, travel demand was going to rebound and you're going to need all those pilots again, you wouldn't want to furlough them. The problem, of course, Peter, is that nobody knows what's going to happen in the future, how long all this is going to last. But absolutely, there can be more costs to sort of doing without a pilot for a short period of time than just to keeping that pilot employed, even if not fully productively.
So just briefly, with the stakes as high as they are, do you think Congress is feeling the pressure to figure this out? Are we going to get a deal?
You know, I thought we would have seen one long ago, Peter. There are obviously a lot of priorities in this country. Airlines and their workers, fortunate that they are on the radar, right? Lots of other people who aren't being considered like them right now, but no guarantee of anything.
Yeah. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
In last night's debate, the president took aim at Vice President Biden's son, Hunter, who once sat on the board of Burisma in Ukraine.
And he didn't have a job until you became vice president. And once you
None
became
of that
vice president,
true.
He made a fortune in Ukraine, in China, in Moscow.
That is simply
well, Ukraine at the time was struggling to get out of Russia's grip. Republicans say Biden's anti-corruption work in Ukraine was compromised by his son being on a board, something that a GOP Senate report just concluded was awkward but did not compromise Joe Biden's work. So that's that. Today we want to take a look at Russia's grip on the U.S., and how that story plays a role. FBI Director Christopher Wray said this month the Russians are very actively trying to influence our 2020 elections. And Vox magazine national security writer Jen Kirby writes about how that interference has evolved since 2016, including hiring unwitting Americans to write for their faux websites. Jen, welcome.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Well, just fine. But this is pretty disturbing. And it was for these writers that you met. You talked with a freelance writer named Jack Delaney. We have spoken with him off air. And a butcher blogger from Queens. Why don't you start with him? That's Larry Krakow. Briefly synopsize, what was his experience?
He was somebody who had a pretty troubling bout with the coronavirus and came out of that pretty angry and started his own blog where he was taking up issues that he was passionate about and cared about. He came across this upstart progressive news site named Peace Data, and he, you know, reached out to them and said, you know, we're working on the same issues and we might be a good fit. And from there, he began to actually write articles for them, hoping for a bigger platform.
And then that Peace Data blog was shut down because it was actually what?
According to a research firm named Graphica, based on a tip from the FBI, the social media companies realized that this was connected to the Internet Research Agency, which we might remember from the 2016 election, which had been responsible for sowing discord and spreading propaganda online. And so this was sort of a new iteration of this, and it definitely shows a little bit how the Russian playbook is changing.
And we want to talk more about how it's changing. But you also met someone else, Jack Delaney. This is a 26-year-old freelance writer just looking for new gigs. He also starts writing. Tell us briefly his story.
He's, you know, been a progressive blogger. He's written about progressive issues and so has a particular point of view. And someone who he thought was an editor reached out to him and, you know, asked him if he might be interested in freelancing. The discussions evolved and they kind of offered a potential for a weekly column, which, you know, he definitely realized this was an upstart place. It looked like it wasn't the best well-run, but he thought, hey, this could be a big break. It's a new site. It could turn into something big. Eventually, he too kind of grew disillusioned with the blog and sort of came to his own conclusions that it wasn't totally above board before it was officially shut down.
Well, for one thing, he saw red flags, including that a profile picture for Alex LaCosta, who was supposed to be the Peace Data editor, looked curiously like the profile picture of another site editor. Both of them turned out to be AI-generated avatars. You know, quick question. So this gets shut down. They both, Jack and Larry, realize, and I'm sure there are others, realize they've been duped. But, you know, how does this fit into the picture? Because these are, you know, people with liberal progressive leanings. How does that fit into what we're hearing is Russia's goal of undermining Joe Biden and the left?
I mean, I think in some respects it is a little bit opaque still. They definitely had a point of view, but they're not necessarily something you wouldn't see on another progressive site. You know, one of Jack Delaney's articles was about U.S. policy towards Venezuela, criticizing it. One of Larry Krakow's pieces was about corruption or questions around the CARES Act. The question is really, why? And I think part of it is that on its face, it's to put these articles and progressive leaning issues into the atmosphere. And, you know, what is interesting to me is Jack Delaney had noticed that one of his articles had ended up on another site, which had much more blatant conspiracy theories and pro-Russia propaganda. So it's sort of, I think, about putting some of these stories into the ecosystem, muddling the conversation a little bit. And I guess on its face, it's to, you know, sow discord within the left, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, and Jack found one of his articles on a pro-Russia propaganda site. So if he was writing something that might even be slightly critical of the United States government, once it's on a pro-Russia site as an example of somebody criticizing the U.S. government, it becomes weaponized.
Exactly, yes. And then all of a sudden it starts cropping up alongside, you know, pro-Putin propaganda, and then it confuses the reader or the consumer of the news, and that's Russia's goal.
Well, what is the goal now? Because we know the goal in 2016 was to, in different ways through social media, divide Americans, send one message to, let's say, a black community or black activists, a lie, and that totally ginned them up, send another one to white militia members. That's still going on. But now, you know, you have Americans unwittingly writing articles. First of all, it makes it sound more American because you could tell sometimes a Russian bot because the English was not quite right. But also, you and others are pointing out that all the Russians have to do is sit back and amplify the things that, for instance, the president is already saying. Russians have been trying to seed distrust of mail-in voting, for instance. They can just use the president's words.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the thing to think about the Russians is they're kind of throwing a lot of strategies at the wall and seeing what sticks. And they saw what they did in 2016, some of which was really effective, you know, such as sowing that discord and propaganda, and some of it which was less effective, you know, for example, having posts with a lot of grammatical errors that looked a little bit suspicious or bots. So they've adjusted and adapted their tactics to kind of fit a little bit better into our internet ecosystem. And they're absolutely responding to what is happening in the United States in real time. Russia did not create the tensions that exist within the American political system. They are trying to exploit them. And so, as you mentioned, the questions around voting by mail and voter fraud are a perfect opportunity for them because essentially Americans are creating the content and they just need to take it and amplify it and sow that distrust, sow that discord, discredit American institutions and democracy, and either give people the sense that everything's rigged, so they're going to give up, or they check out of the system because they don't really know what to believe. Yeah.
And that brings us to Ukraine. And we're just going to spend a minute here to remind people that this isn't new, this idea of using Americans, you know, their actual words to sow discord, because we remember that as the president was, you know, accusing Joe Biden falsely last night, Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, yes, had a very controversial seat on a board of a company in Ukraine, while then Vice President Joe Biden was charged with fighting corruption there just after Ukraine had thrown off its Russian president and was trying to get out of the grip of Russia. And as Donald Trump and his supporters in this country tried to turn that into Joe Biden being influenced by his son, which all investigations found there was no truth to that, Biden still fought corruption. You had people like Rudy Giuliani, as you write, still going to Ukraine to dig up dirt. You have Donald Trump trying to leverage the new Ukrainian president to get him dirt on Joe Biden in order to get military aid. And this was exactly what the Russians wanted. The Russians, you write, were happy to use Giuliani and Donald Trump to sow distrust of the new president in Ukraine.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this was a perfect opportunity for them, you know, Russia wants to pretend that it didn't interfere in the elections in 2016. And they found eager, you know, listeners in some of Trump's allies and the Republican Party. And this idea that they have promoted that Joe Biden had somehow kind of compromised U.S. foreign policy because of his son Hunter Biden's position on the board of a Ukrainian energy company, Burisma, which was the center of the impeachment scandal.
Information that they got from Andriy Dercok, correct? A Ukrainian politician who had ties to Russian intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, he's allegedly gotten his hands on some recordings of Joe Biden's conversations with the former Ukrainian president Poroshenko that are supposed to show some sort of corruption. They've clearly been edited, and they haven't quite really penetrated sort of the mainstream media, but in right-wing circles and in right-wing media, these are sort of part of that kind of grand conspiracy, and they're very much a Russian disinformation operation. You know, Dercok himself has been sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury for meddling in the U.S. election. So it's all out there in plain sight, but yet somehow it's still getting obscured in our political conversation.
Vox national security writer Jen Kirby will link you to her recent article, Yes, Russia is Interfering in the 2020 Election, at herenow.org. Jen, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
During last night's presidential debate between President Trump and Joe Biden, moderator Chris Wallace of Fox News struggled to maintain order in the face of near constant interruptions from Trump. Here's Wallace calling for a reset of the debate midway through.
I think that the country would be better served if we allowed both people to speak with fewer interruptions. I'm appealing to you, sir, to do that.
Well, and him too.
Well, frankly, you've been doing more interrupting than he has.
Well, that's all right, but he does plenty.
Well, less than, sir,
yeah,
less than,
plenty.
No, less than you have. Let's please continue on.
Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, Chris Wallace said before this debate that he wanted to be as invisible as possible as a moderator. We just heard that did not work by any stretch of the imagination. What did you think of his approach last night?
I think that Chris Wallace is one of the more accomplished and tough-minded interviewers, an extremely experienced moderator, and yet, by the same token, wildly outmatched by the bulldozer-in-chief that was President Trump up on that stage. He did appeal, as he said there. There were a couple points where he said the president needed to let Joe Biden speak. There are other points where he basically said, please let me just get through my question. It's going to be one you want to answer on a subject you want to talk about, sort of pleading for calm in a way, as Nicole Wallace, no relation of MSNBC, pointed out after the debate, was almost like appeasing kind of an emotionally abusive relative at a holiday dinner. You know, this was not a symmetrical performance or debate. And Wallace, you know, a very straight ahead reporter and journalist who I think tries to be incredibly fair minded, even at Fox News, not necessarily always known for that. Nonetheless, you know, was unable to step beyond that to find a way to corral the president in this. And it just was one of the most disruptive disheartening civic events we've seen in a presidential race in many, many, many years.
I mean, it may have been the hardest assignment of his career, and it's easy to cast stones in that position, but could anyone have done it better, David? I mean, what else could Chris Wallace have done to rein in, as you say, the bulldozer in chief?
Hard to know who could have done it better. I do think that partly Wallace was constrained by an image of himself as being fair-minded, you know, and unwilling to step beyond that. You know, you might have seen what would have happened with a question and say, Mr. President, why aren't you willing to allow the voters to actually hear what you and the former vice president have to say? Why are you violating the rules that you and your campaign agreed to set up this very event? And just sort of address that as a question. You know, it's a meta question that nonetheless might force the president to pause and answer. Probably wouldn't, but you'd at least have that on the record there. You know, Jim Lehrer, who has moderated a lot of these debates, the former and now retired PBS host, did so very evenly. He once wrote a novel about what it would be if two debate moderators decide to hijack the format in order to hone in on a candidate who actually proved to be a criminal. And you know, there are ways in which you kind of have to think unconventionally, and I think given the rules that Wallace himself agreed to, it would have been very hard for almost anyone to take command of it. He didn't, for example, as many people ask, have the ability to cut off the microphone of one of the candidates to let the other to speak. Right. Neither he nor his producers. And you've just heard this afternoon, shortly before you and I started to speak now, that the Commission on Presidential Debates has come out and said, we're going to have to review some of our policies and rules to make for a better public discourse on this.
Nor did Wallace serve as a fact checker, which he warned people about ahead of time that he wasn't going to do that. Was it a mistake?
You know, he did do it more than you might have thought from his public pronouncements. He just made clear that wasn't going to be his role to pick apart things and to be prosecutorial. There were moments, for example, on healthcare where he simply rejected the president's untrue assertions, false assertions, that the president had made major policy changes and recommendations that would replace Obamacare. The president simply hasn't, although he's been in office for years, and Wallace held him to that. But he didn't do it a lot. That might have been a good thing to do, but, you know, Trump tried to turn this at the outset a bit into a debate between him and Wallace, just as he did at the first primary debate in August of 2015 in the Republican field when he started to soar, and he turned it against Wallace, but more his then-colleague Megyn Kelly of Fox News. He attempted to do that, and I think Wallace didn't want to be caught in that bind.
Here we are in the middle of a devastating pandemic. A lot of issues in this country that could have been discussed in depth. It didn't really happen. But does that mean it was a waste, David? Did this serve voters or viewers in any way, to your mind?
I think the case can be made that, you know, you were able to understand the tenor and the nature and to some degree the character of the candidates by the way in which they approached this debate, that they revealed themselves in this cauldron of impatience and anger. You know, Joe Biden called the sitting president of the United States a clown, and in any other debate performance, that would have essentially been front page news. I still remember 20 years ago, then Vice President Al Gore's size two or three times during a debate with George W. Bush was seen as intemperate and unpresidential, and it got a lot of headlines. You know, Biden calling President Trump a clown would have been that wasn't even among the top 17 things to report on in this debate. So
told him to shut up at one point.
That's
amazing,
right.
So amazing night, David. I got to cut you off right there, but thank you very much, David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The presidential candidates are trying to appeal to working class voters. We'll speak with a pro-Trump union member in Ohio and a pro-Biden union member in Michigan. That's next time on Here and Now.